Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I noticed that more people are sitting in chairs. This is not a failure. It's just called old age. But if I suggest that you do develop a good sitting practice on a chair. If you need to, then just as like if you were used to sitting on the floor and then you need to use a chair, then try to again get the mental state that we develop in the sitting posture. So you have a bench or you have a cushion and you set yourself up. Try to do the same with a chair, because a chair, you can kind of cross your legs and sit like that or whatever. But actually figure out what would be the equivalent of the chair posture to your sitting posture. So for me, what's important is that my hips are higher than my knees, and then that tilts my pelvis forward, and then that lifts my back, lifts my spine. So I find that very important. So most of us do that. We have benches or zafus or so on. So maybe, if you're sitting on a chair, think about that. If you're sitting too much back in a chair, then that closes your hara and your spine curves forward. And so some people, what they do is they actually, I know one monk who has a lot of problems in his shins, and he has to sit on a chair, and so he puts a 2x4 under the back legs. So he actually raises the back of the chair forward, so he's sitting on a slant, and he finds that really helps him to then be forward more. Then consider, when you're sitting on the floor, you have to hold your own back up, and that requires vitality and effort, and that is oftentimes sufficient to keep you awake. So in a chair, you don't have that maybe, so you lean back a bit, and then if you lean back again, it closes your hara a bit, and your chest closes a bit, so that has an effect. So then if you need to lean against the chair, considering a bolster in the small of the back, and I mean, these are obvious things, but if you just go through the exercise of, well, what would a good chair posture be, and then just get past the sort of oddness of it, because if you've been used to sitting on the floor, but now the body's just finding it too difficult, or you like to alternate between the two, get past the sort of oddness of it. Just kind of work with it until then that also becomes, yeah, this is a meditation posture. So that whole attitude that we bring to meditation, just through association, I guess, you do that in a chair. And as I was mentioning, first or second day, also the lying posture. See if you can develop that, and then in the walking posture too. Say like when you begin, like you have the walking meditation path. Say in our monasteries, each of the huts, we try to construct a walking meditation path. And Ajahn Chah, in our tradition, we encourage walking meditation a lot. It's difficult where we are in Perth because we have a lot of bugs. And it's pretty cold in the winter, so we're kind of still working on how to do that. But just imagine you've got a hut and you've got this path where you do meditation all the time. So just by getting on the path, it has the same associations as having a zafu and a shrine and so on. So that we have that way of associating wholesomeness and goodness with places and situations and shrines. And so try to bring that into the walking meditation, where it's not like a botanizing walk or birding. That's a different kind of a walk. This is like really much more much more contained, I suppose. So you start at one end of the path, and you really contain your whole posture through looking down at the ground. It's not looking around now, looking at the vulture or something like that. I mean, you can do that, but it's more like a containment. Just as when you do sitting meditation, you don't kind of look around and see how everyone's doing, because then it might be entertaining. You're probably not, but then you're just distracted, obviously. So you have a kind of discipline, don't you? So same with the walking meditation. You kind of set your posture up. Set your body, get into your body, feel your body, feel the body touching the ground, listen to the silence, and then make an intention to try to walk mindfully, try to walk in the body, feet in the feet. And then you just use that as your meditation. And then if you really have some kind of strong thoughts are coming up, you can just stop, listen, and then walk to the end. I mean, you make the turning around very deliberate, stop, and you walk deliberately. And that whole pattern then becomes very much associated with calming the mind, centering the mind, and it becomes a lovely posture to be practicing in. And so the four postures. Standing I've never really, really developed myself. I've only met one monk who does it. I guess people do qigong, huh? They must be good at that, because that's a kind of natural. Ajahn Sucitto must be good at that. He does qigong. I've never developed it. I did see one monk. He was just visiting us in Wellington, and he stood for a couple of hours. He said he just liked standing meditation. So that was interesting. But just that sense of, like, if you're sitting in a chair or whatever, trying to create the right intention, so you're setting up your mind for that. So maybe I just go through these questions first and then see what kind of dharma comes out of that. So, for the past 2 years, I tense my right jaw when I meditate. I can't stop it. Telling myself not to doesn't help. Telling myself that this is the way things are doesn't help. It gets so tense that it hurts a lot. Do you have any suggestions? Well, one thing I would ask a dentist to see, you're grinding your teeth at night. That could be that happens. It just comes on for reasons which aren't so clear to medicine from what I've read. So that could be. It could be just the kind of grinding of the teeth. And then that's actually dangerous for your teeth. So then you kind of need a mouth guard. Otherwise, if one has something kind of chronically tense, then what I try to do is I try to be receptive. I think that's, for me, is the key. I try to be receptive to the manifestation rather than aggressive. I don't know what the word is. But just let this kind of language that I use, let this very tension become conscious rather than me looking at it with my eyes. See what I mean? So just like I would suggest that, like, when that tension comes up, let it come up into consciousness rather than trying to look at it. And that, maybe that doesn't sound like much of a difference, but it is in my way of practice. And then let the feelings just manifest just the way they are. But also, I mean, that's about all I would really know. But also, I just check it out with a doctor or a dentist or someone to see if there's some physiological reason that's happening. But it's interesting that the person said that I do it only during meditation. That's the first time I've heard that. And one side of the jaw. Interesting. What does that mean? Does that mean... So then I guess I'd investigate, well, what is meditation for me? Why? Does, like, if I'm just outside looking at the birds, does my right jaw clench? And I think what's helpful is to see contrasts, like when does something arise and take place, and when is it not there, and what's the transition? Why is there a transition? So I guess I would observe the non-clenching of the jaw. I just see what's non-clenching. Is there all the time? And then I try to see how does it arise? What are the causal factors for it to arise? So trying to get some insight, especially if in fact it comes up in meditation. Maybe the person would then notice actually it's there more than I thought. I'm not sure. But if it's an on and off experience and it is in a particular activity, then there should be some insight around how it triggers, you know, how it comes about. And hopefully from that there'd be some kind of insight. This is the way it is now can be a kind of just an intellectual thing, kind of commentary. So actually it's just a way of trying to say kind of to really come into the body, to kind of dropping the thoughts and being with it. I guess I'd also look at the desire to get rid of it, which would be pretty natural, you know, because it's a nuisance. So aversion to that or worry around that, and then try to see it. What is it like before the worry and before the aversion to it? So a kind of purity of attention, which is hard. If there's something so difficult, you pay attention to it because you're trying to sort it out. So then that's where the receptivity comes. That attitude of receptivity is one that is not trying to accomplish anything. It's not trying to achieve anything or do anything about this. But that can be a suggestion, but it might be quite difficult to enact. This is the words are easy. It's easy to say, oh, just receive it. So trying to get, that's really what metta is about, I think. The practices of goodwill are practices which aren't just about people. They're this whole attitude of the heart to our kind of conscious experience. If you get a good result, let me know. So when the next person asks, I can give some suggestions. Anapanasati, what point of concentration? So anapanasati is mindfulness of breathing, and sometimes it's taught to concentrate at the nose. So you feel the coolness of the air, and the meditation is on the physical sensation of this point there rather than following the breath in and out. Some teachers teach to observe it at the hara, to watch the rise and fall, this movement down here. Yoga teachers or yoga perceptions of it are quite often allow the whole breath to flow through the body, so you get a whole body experience. I quite often do it at the heart. So there is no particular way you need to do it. People who focus at people who get too tense tend to not like to focus at the nostrils because they tend to try too hard and they're kind of up in the head. So those people oftentimes like being in the hara. If the meditation becomes too narrow, and that's one of the problems, you get too focused, too narrow, you need to somehow broaden your attention to make your attention broad. So even with the breath at the nose, if it becomes too tight, it doesn't really work. So you have a kind of more broad sense, and that's the general center. But allowing the breath to kind of permeate the body, so feeling the breath go through the arms, down through the legs, that's very, very opening. So some ways of breath meditation are very, very focused. Some are more kind of general. Quite often the problem is doubt. It's got nothing to do with the breath. You just, the mind just doesn't know how to settle on an object. So because the mind can't settle on the object, you think, well, breath, nose, stomach, nose. And it's, the problem is the doubt, right? It's not where you focus. So just choose one of these options and just do it for a year. And then you'll figure out what you have to do. And the thing about meditation techniques is they, quite often you get off on novelty. So teacher gives you yet another angle on a meditation technique, and the novelty creates interest, and the interest then keeps you in that method. But eventually the novelty wears off, and then you fall asleep or the usual whatever troubles we have, and so novelty itself is not reliable. So then you have the real work. You know, you have a kind of way of meditation which appeals to you, and then you just start to do it for the sake of doing it, and then the very doing becomes part of the craft. Just like the example I like to give is in weaving. You set up the loom, and there's the warp and the weft, and you put the weft through and all that. And by doing it, you make lots of mistakes. But you just keep doing it. The tension is wrong, and you get the shuttles, lift them wrong, and it's too tight or too loose, and you just keep doing it. And so the learning is actually in the doing. It's not really the technique. It's in the doing. Because in the doing, you have the struggle of the hindrances. You get bored with it, you get dull, you have doubt, you think you should jump from one thing to another. And then you see what your mind does when you try to contain it in a meditation technique. You begin to understand the kind of the character you're working with the strengths and weaknesses. You try too hard, and you get really fierce at it, and then that doesn't work maybe, or it does work. So it is a kind of craft that you have to give it a good long go. If it doesn't work in the first 2 weeks, I wouldn't worry about it. But if it doesn't work in the first 2 weeks and you just keep chopping and changing, you become a kind of dilettante of meditation. You don't really have a few things that you can go to. I find that most people have a kind of repertoire which works for them. So some people are like good at visualization. I'm not good at visualization. I never do those kinds of practices. And they have a few things which intuitively they've picked up, and that's what works for them, and they go back. And when you do find something which somehow strikes your interest, that you can sustain and kind of does work for you, then really hone it, really get good at it, because that's your old friend. Ah, yeah, there's the breath, or there's the heart, or whatever you like, and that's a kind of, through the years, you really appreciate that. Yeah. What is the purpose of saying this is how it feels? Is it to cultivate the witness stance, to cultivate equanimity with how things are, or is there more to it? Well, I'm trying to use language, and the language is not so important, but to enter into the present moment without commentary, I suppose, and to enter the present moment, even the sense of a doer or a witness falls away. So it's dropping into the present moment in a way where past and future are no longer preoccupying attention, and attention is really one with the way things are. So how do you say that? This moment feels this way. And then within that, because it's such a simple thing, I think what often happens is doubt comes up. Am I doing it right? And that needs to be known. That very because it's so ordinary. And because you think, well, come on, there's got to be more to this than that. And it can't be that. Come on. This isn't rocket science. And the mind begins to doubt, and the beauty of it, or the simplicity of it, evades us, because We think it should be more. And just dropping into or letting or knowing the way things are, in the beginning it's very bland. You know, it's very kind of ho-hum, so what? Okay, what's next? You know, and so the desire mind, you know, you hear someone talk, oh, wow, this sounds good. So what, there's nothing happening, and because we're used to quite often what we're seeking in meditation is more of an acid trip than peace. You know, we want some kind of altered experience of consciousness or deep peace or whatever it is. So just the ordinariness of looking at the shelves, you know, watching paint dry. What's the point of that? And yet, in that ordinary, one of the teachers that I read, he says, you wait, but wait for nothing. Wait, but wait for nothing. Now, obviously, if my mind's very upset and so on and so forth, I need to somehow work through that. But you know, if you've been meditating for a while, you get tired of always constructing mind states. You're always been building up peace, and then it crumbles on you. I know I do. So that the sense of me always having to do something, that becomes limited. In the beginning, like I said, you know, you count your breaths. Lompo Sumedho, he tells us about his early days. He was a rabid thinker, and he just would do things like let go, 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 let go. You know, he just filled his mind with something else, really, literally. Because his mind was so rabid with thought. So there are kind of gradations of effort that we make. And so sometimes, as I said, you know, just count your breaths and do that. But after a while, you begin to intuit the sense of relaxed attention. You begin to appreciate that. It's how the simplicity of that. You begin to just abide as that. And then you do more subtle kind of things like watch the next moment. And don't let the kind of seeming mundaneness of it fool you, because we're not seeking excitement. We're not even seeking interest, because like if you think something has to be interesting, then you when it's uninteresting, you're caught in those polarities. I mean, it is interesting investigating silence. I do find that interesting. But so when I say this is how it feels, it's simply to kind of let go of all the constructs of doing anything about the moment. Other ways you might talk about it: non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Different ways. This is the way it is now. And in that, there's no commentary. No non-becoming. I like the non-words a lot. So whatever, you know, witness stance, this is different kind of language. But before all that language comes, before what is this moment like? And again, you cannot describe it. You can describe it, but really that's never it. I mean, what is a rose like? It's beautiful, it's fragrant, it's whatever. So sometimes we talk about suchness, we use that kind of word, suchness. Relaxed attention, this kind of language. Where I think you intuit it very strongly is when you're meditating and then your mind gets caught up with maybe a fantasy about something and then someone sneezes. And in that moment, this is the way it is now, arises or is known. And that's the gap or the crack. And if you set up your intentions, if you set up your intentions such that you say to yourself, when the thinking, I'm going to notice the end of a thought, say. Set up the intention that way. Notice the end of a thought. Then when that comes up, that moment of clarity, then that's what we mean. It's just this way. And that moment can be very brief because we very quickly jump to some idea that we're not meditating well. Or we don't notice it and we just, you know, pass on to the next fantasy. So we tend to go from object to object to object to object to object to object to object. And now we're trying to see the gap between objects, the gap between thoughts. And then you begin to intuit that underlying all this kind of objective consciousness that we have, there is this, what, ultimate subject or something like that. I don't know what word you'd use, because there is no real person there. Yeah? It's a kind of intuitive thing too, isn't it? If Nibbana is the hub of the wheel, is the heart a spoke or is it the hub? I don't know. I'm working on that one. A very good question. So stay tuned. Or let me know. If Nibbana is the hub of the wheel, is the heart a spoke or is it the hub? I reckon it's a part of the hub, but for me, it's probably there's still too much of the doer there to realize that. That's what my kind of speculation of it is. So I think it's a very interesting question. If you understand it, send me a postcard. I'd appreciate it. Can you please explain the triple bowing in this tradition, its meaning, significance, what is the correct way to do it? Well, the three bows are to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the three refuges. And, you know, the Tibetans bow different than Theravada, and even in Theravada a different way. So basically you're on your haunches, is that the word? On your shins. And then when you bow, you basically touch your heart, your head, and then you bring your hands down first, and you keep your hands just kind of head distance apart so you don't do push-ups. You do that. And you try to keep your body quite tight. So when I was learning how to bow, my backside would go to the heavens, so my backside would not be on my heels. And I was a novice, and I was the only novice who was 25. The other novices were 12 or 13. So they would poke me in the bottom. They were cute kids. So your bottom stays with your heels, if you can, and then you bow down, and then you try to have your elbows by your knees. So it's quite a compact thing. And then your forehead touches the ground between your hands. And then you come up and do that three times. You come up to your heart, to your head, and then down again. Hands going out first, then body following. I should do a YouTube on this. Bowing is, it's just a lovely... It's a lovely gesture. It's the body language of humility and gratitude for me. And so, like the shrine, obviously the Buddha is not an idol. It's a symbol. It's a symbol both of the being who has made this life possible for me. So tremendous gratitude and awe for this being. And then also the very image is also the awakened mind, so bowing to that as well. Not a necessary part of Buddhism, but all traditions seem to have developed it. And then we bow to our teachers in the same way, out of reverence and respect. In a monastery, we would bow to the... If we left the monastery, we would bow to the teacher when we came. So when I go back to the monastery, everyone will gather and then bow to me. And it's not just to me, but it's more just a way that we've developed for paying respect to the elders, having a sense of deference to elders, So it's a kind of, it's a very beautiful, beautiful kind of thing to do. And if you're really having a hard time, just keep bowing. You know, if you're just going through some terrible bardo realm that you're going to have to survive, just bow. Just get in front of the shrine, just bow. I don't know what's going on. Just bow 20 times, 30 times. Just bow like that. So it's an acquired taste, I think, the bowing. But obviously in Asia, it's a very strong thing to do. So whenever we visit a monastery, first thing we go to the main shrine, try to bow to the main shrine, then we seek out the abbot, senior teacher, go and pay respect there. When we leave, we do the same thing. Whenever a senior monk visits a monastery, the abbot would gather all the monks, they'd come and they'd bow to the senior monk. And so it's quite a strong tradition. And there is a strong sense of deference to elders in our tradition, and a way of expressing that, which is quite lovely, quite beautiful. And like in a men's community, I'm used to living in men's communities, there's a gentleness there that is I think rather admirable. So the kind of usual competitiveness of maybe male communities or those kinds of things, that's all smoothed out, and although that might exist in people's minds, it can't really manifest socially, or because there's these very soft ways of relating, so that like the junior monks would, as Philip is taking care of me, the junior monks take really good care of me. They clean my hut for me, they wash my clothing for me, and it's so part of my training with junior monks is to have them take care of me, which is a kind of odd feeling, but it's kind of my duty is to get to know a junior monk if I've taken him on as a disciple, and then he will then take care of my needs. He'll make sure whatever dietary needs I have, he'll make sure my alms bowl is there. He'll ask me, do I need anything? Can I pack your bag for you? And it's very important, I think, in a men's community for men to learn to do that, to serve, to be humble, to be grateful to the elders. And the effect is very good. The effect over the years is very good. In the beginning, it's a bit rough going. So sometimes I think, I'd rather do it myself, actually. But then the result is very, very good. So that it's a kind of softening of the male consciousness and a male social form, which is very necessary. And that's what you see, like a monastery where there is good training in that way. There is this kind of beautiful dance that goes on, kind of a lovely sort of choreography of devotion and respect for each other and for the elders. See, I like we used to massage Ajahn Chah's feet. He had beautiful feet. Oh, just the softest little feet. It's lovely. And then sometimes you'd be with an abbot who you didn't really like. And then, of course, the judgmental mind, I'm not bowing to him. Been there a year, right? I'm not bowing to him. And you say, oh, I don't want to be like that. That's not where I want to go. So the whole idea of even thinking, well, I'm only going to bow to those guys I really respect, only the good meditation monks. You know, oh, come on, give me a break. And you'd see that in the mind. You say, no, that's not what it's about. It's not about your ego. It's about giving up your ego. So then just it's a very beautiful thing to do, just bow for the sake of deference and so on. So bowing is quite a powerful part of our life in our monastic life. Did I answer those? Those are quick, yeah, I think so. Yeah. One more. This morning you mentioned that you use your spine a lot as a meditation anchor. Could you elaborate? P.S. Will I ever get all the crackles out? Probably not. But anyway, you know, do your best. You won't find perfection in the body, obviously, but it is a vehicle that we use. So we're very fortunate that now in Western culture we have yoga and Tai Chi and Qigong and Pilates, and I mean, different flavors of yoga now are stunning. Hot yoga and... Anyway, so that can be different ways like that. But for me, the spine seems to me to be the kind of energy indicator. So I've always tried to create a posture where I'm able to use my hara and push my hara out to elevate the spine, and then to learn how to push the top of my head upwards so that I stretch my neck and I can get a good stretch. And then I also allow my coccyx, or the base of my spine, to go down into the ground, so I get a kind of a double stretch. And I'll do that. I'll quite often start out like that, and just like a good yoga stretch, really, and just make it extreme, maybe even, and then settle into the posture. And then if I feel sleepy, or sometimes just naturally that happens to the body, that doing the breath meditation and the body wants to do that, it wants to elevate, it wants to stretch. And so just exploring what that feels like. Just sometimes doing that as a kind of body meditation. What's the spine doing now? How would that feel? So it's not like a super concentrated or focused practice, but it can be quite energizing and quite well. So then after a while, and when the mind is more calm, then I don't do it deliberately, but the body might do it itself, just through the, seems to be a natural kind of process. But what I think deeper than that, it indicates that we are, you know, we're energy beings. We have bodies, energy bodies, physical bodies. We have emotional beings. We have intellect. So there's a whole range of things that are going on in our conscious experience, and to understand and have some insight around all those is very helpful, because then you have a way of understanding yourself, which is not just through thought, not just through a kind of a commentary. That's helpful, obviously, to have good perspectives on cause and effect and have a good analytical mind, but also just to viscerally understand yourself when you're tired, what your energy body feels like. When you're restless, what your energy body feels like. When your heart's open, what the emotional body is like. When you're closed down with resentment or aversion, what that's like. So you're learning about yourself in all these different ways, not to necessarily just change it all, but to take you back to that knowing the way things are. So when you like, for me, if I'm feeling exhausted and tired, that's the first thing I do. Oh, wow, this is really tired now. This is tired. Tired feels this way. Then make a choice. Go to sleep or rest, or if I can't, then hey, what should I do? And then I kind of play around with it. So that's always leading back to more and more awareness, through not just trying to get rid of things and become something different, because the practice is not really becoming. Really, it's more like dropping the hindrances that prevent clear knowing. Now, I think that way of looking at the practice I find much more helpful than I am someone who is limited right now, and I need to just hammer away at this so that in the future, at some future date, then I'll be free of all this rubbish or difficulty or hindrance, whatever. So that to me seems to be grounded in wrong view. And that wrong view is that I am someone who wants to become something. Avijja paccaya sankhara, as we say in Pali. Whereas the awakened mind, to me it seems that's not something you become, it's more that you remember. So that's why I think I use the image of the bicycle. And then getting a sense of balance, and then seeing what prevents that balance and letting go of it. To me, that's a different approach. It's not a becoming. It's a remembering and coming back home, rather than trying to find your home somewhere in the future. To me, that's an important distinction. So if I have some, like I was just reading some notes on Ajahn Chah, there's a, you've probably read the story where he's talking with someone under his kuti, and there's a palmist, someone who reads palms, they have lots of that kind of stuff in Thailand. He's kind of watching his hands. So Ajahn Chah's just, you know, and he's kind of trying to see his hands, see what's on his palms. He's a palm reader. And finally he gets his courage up and says, Ajahn Chah, could I look at your palms? And Ajahn Chah was not really into that kind of business. So he gave him a bit of a ribbing. He says, oh, all right, go ahead. So he looks at his palms. And he looks at Ajahn Chah. He says, you've got a lot of anger. You've got a lot of anger. And Ajahn Chah, what he says, yeah, but I don't use it. I thought, wow, that's interesting. Huh? That's interesting. Whereas if anger arises in consciousness, having said that, I mean, the man was just amazing. I couldn't quite figure out that story, actually, because I never saw him angry. But one of the things it indicates to me is that if anger arises in consciousness, and I think that I'm someone who has an anger problem, and I have to do like 10 tons of metta practice in order to be someone who doesn't have anger, that to me is wrong understanding, because it's taking anger personally. It's not my anger, it's anger. Anger is this way. Whereas witnessing and knowing that anger feels just this way, and that that my real home is not the anger, it's the knowing, then there is a choice to not engage it, because there's mindfulness, and then the anger runs its course, and there's nowhere to go, so one always stays home. And to me that seems to be the way it works for me, at least. Now if someone was so troubled and confused that they didn't know their anger, they're consumed or overwhelmed with the anger, then some kind of therapies and all of that, and a different kind of language needs to be used, obviously. But for, you know, for most of us, we're not, you know, our passions aren't so overwhelming. I guess that's the way I'd put it. And they're just, you know, you're more garden variety kind of passions. And then that means we have very good karma, that we have enough mindfulness to be with this. And then it's okay, it's all right to feel just terrible and awful and jealous and cruel. We just don't go there. We don't do it. So even if you have a cruel thought, you know, a jealous thought or a jealous feeling in the guts or whatever, it's, jealousy's this way. So always the reference is our real home, to know these things, as opposed to, oh God, there's jealousy again, I'm a terrible person, which creates the whole self view. And that's the problem, that's what we'd say is the problem. So that was a lot, wasn't it? Thank you for the questions. Helps me. Shall we finish with some chanting? Yeah?